walk away with clarity around the topic of elder care, whether that's for yourself as you're aging or as you're navigating this topic with your parents. Signature FD is an independently owned wealth management firm based here in Atlanta. We have about $6 billion of assets under management. In our approach to financial management, we believe in the intersection of your wealth, which is the accumulation of more, and your worth, the achievement of better, as we help you to navigate your financial world, helping you to find what we call your net worthwhile. I'd like to introduce you to Vicki Shackley, who will be moderating this panel. Vicki started her career as a tax and estate attorney prior to entering into the wealth management field. She has 25 years experience in the industry, excellently serving clients in their wealth management needs. She is a partner here at Signature FD and was named the leader of the Signature Women team in 2021. She's also been a personal mentor of mine at my time here at Signature FD. So, Vicki, take it away.
And you did the large print. That was smart. We're all aging.
So, as Clara said, I'm Vicki, and I am the director of Signature Women. And I came up, okay, this is going to be hard because I can't look out at you. And so I came up with the idea for this event. I had my first girls' weekend with my friends from college in April. And times have really changed, you know. It's no longer who's having a baby, who's getting married. It's like my dad's got dementia and my mom's in assisted living and my mom was scammed $100,000 by a guy and I just thought, oh my God, we're not in Kansas anymore. Like we are people of a certain age with parents of a certain age. But I also realized is nobody knows what resources are out there and where to begin with this. It's very overwhelming from navigating the doctors, the care, what types of care, the expenses, the end-of-life decisions that come along. So what we wanted to do today is kind of just provide you and introduce you to some people that I've worked with over the years that can help you kind of build that team and have those conversations. So with us today is Sam Evans, who's an attorney with Hurley Elder Care, and that's a firm up in Marietta that is dedicated to serving the elderly and their families, and we've worked with them for years and always have a good experience when we deal with Hurley. We're out of order. Hugh Henderson, Jenny Buckley couldn't make it. She had a family emergency, but Hugh Henderson agreed to be our stand-in guest for Jenny. And he is the owner of Capstone Hospice, and he's going to talk to us about hospice, the myths of hospice, and what palliative care is. And then Michelle Allen is with Aging Life Care of Atlanta. She's a geriatric care coordinator, licensed social worker, and she's really dedicated her career to the care of older adults, and she's a fabulous resource. If you need anything, she can point you in the right direction. Who do I have next? Keith Knapp is the owner of Affordable Medicare Solutions, and he assists individuals with the Medicare enrollment process, reviewing the annual plans, making sure if there's anything going in your life, he's catching that in the annual review and making sure you have the right program for yourself or for your parents. And then Nan Monahan is a founder of Buckhead Internal Medicine, which is concierge medical practice. Located in Piedmont is where she practices, but she also has quite an elderly population and spends several days a week up at Lenbrook, which is kind of a higher-end spectrum care facility. And so we're going to ask her all the questions about what goes wrong and, you know, what do we need to be prepared for and the dynamics of the family and this kind of thing. So if you'll thank me a minute in welcoming our panel, I think you're going to learn a lot. Clara is going to walk around with a microphone. If you have questions, feel free to raise your hand. Clara will come up. I'm just going to fire questions at them. If it brings to mind anything, feel free to speak up. But I'll just start. I'm going to start with the basics. Sam, how do you start to bring up the topic with your wills, with your parents, you know? Do you have wills? Do you have healthcare directives? Do you have a power of attorney? How do you engage? What's a good way to maybe start the conversation?
Well, you know, I think it's a good time to start as any time a major life event happens, right? Whether it be a death in the family, maybe a change in marital status, or, you know, even some of the joyous things, like maybe we got new members of the family, right? And we want to see if grandkids and great-grandkids are going to be a part of our estate planning as well. Also, obviously, if there's any sort of diagnosis, right, anything like that that may affect our ability to execute documents down the road or our decision-making, something like that would really be a time where we say, hey, Mom, hey, Dad, it's kind of time for us to just all get on the same page because we want to be a part of making sure that we're taking care of you and that you're taking care of yourself. Anytime there's a move, whether it be to a new state or to a new city or to, you know, a facility that's maybe got an increase in care, or, you know, kind of like you mentioned earlier, if there's a scam, right, or we have any question as to maybe we're just not as sharp as we once were and we just kind of need to button everything up and make sure that we have a plan in place so that we can really take care of you when you need it. So really it's just kind of being on top of it and making sure that when we see some of those flags that go up, like whether it's a change maybe in a spouse has deceased, or we have maybe one of our children has passed or moved out of state, and so now we need to make sure that maybe, you know, our younger child is going to be the one to step in and help us with those decisions. It's just as we age and our circumstances change, we kind of need to keep a thumb on the pulse and make sure that our planning changes with them.
Okay. Nan, when should we start going to doctor's appointments with their parents or inquiring about their health, and with the limitations that HIPAA hamstrings you with? What's best practice there?
Well, I'm not aware of best practice because the answer is it depends. And I have patients in their 80s that are still working. I have patients in their 60s who are ill and don't take care of are not unable to care for themselves. So it's really all over the board. I think, you know, there are some changes that happen with age that we see a lot of, and some short-term memory loss is normal. You know, we can't do things as fast as we could do when we were 40 or 50, when we're 70 or 80. But I think when we see any sort of decline in function, or, you know, somebody is forgetting to pay bills, someone is forgetting to take medications, pharmacies are calling, asking why medicines haven't been picked up. You know, and it can be pretty subtle, and if there are two people in a home, a lot of times they will cover for each other. So it really, as a child, I think you just have to be sort of paying more attention than in a way that we aren't used to doing as children. And trying to be a little bit more involved and knowing who your doctors are. I have the luxury of having a smaller practice, so I have at times called family members and said, you know, I'm a little worried about your mom, but you can't depend on that being something that's going to happen. And frequently I'll call a child of a patient and they won't really know who their parent's doctor is, and I'm like, oh, everyone should know this. So I think being a little more familiar with what's going on with your parents, if you can be, and if you have concerns, you know, the very best way is to be very open about it and to talk to your parent and say, you know, I'm a little worried about your memory. That may not be very well received, but I think that's always the best policy to begin with, is to try to involve your family member and try to get them to maybe open up to you about it, acknowledge it, and talk about it in an open forum. If that doesn't work and you are concerned about someone's memory and their ability to make good decisions, you're worried about them, HIPAA does limit how we communicate with patients' families unless people have expressly concerned that it's okay. But one thing that you can always do, even if your loved one has not given you permission to discuss things with your doctor, is you can supply your parent's doctor with information without necessarily getting a response back. So often I will have ask family members to send me an email or a fax to supply me with information, which I can freely read. I may not be able to discuss it, but then I will discuss it with the patient and see, are there things that we need to talk about that are important to your health? So it's really a tough answer, but it really is, it depends. But really being attention, paying attention and being involved and looking for little worry signs. So,
Nan, or whoever, jump in. When should we be taking away the keys? And that's a hard discussion.
Oh, that one is really hard. So, again, paying attention. I think driving with a parent every once in a while, especially if someone's had vision problems or is having some cognitive impairment, get in the car with them and see. Whoops. And see how your parent or your spouse does. So that's one thing that's pretty, it can be pretty helpful. You know, certainly warning signs are repeated accidents, fender benders, having unexplained car work, car body work, is how I see it.
My dad told me, a lot of people have been honking at me lately. Yeah, Dad, you're really bad at driving.
You know, as far as when to take the keys away, that is really, I'm getting a lot of feedback here. I'm going to sit away. That's really tough. But I think one of the best things to do is that if you have concerns, you know, you always hope that someone who's having trouble is going to regulate themselves and say, okay, I'm going to stop driving, which does happen every once in a while, but that I would say that is not the norm. So, and there's a lot of, there's no fight that's bigger among family. I can't think of a much bigger fight than taking away the keys. So one of the best ways that we do it is take it out of the family's hands and put it in the hands of an objective person that is not related. So I do comprehensive driving tests, Shepherd and Emory, and I don't, do you know who else does them in town? Michelle?
Yes. There's another independent provider, Freedom and Mobility. I'm sorry. Freedom and Mobility is another driving evaluation service where they do on-road testing.
Which is really helpful. Mm-hmm. And if push comes to shove, if you were really worried about danger, you can talk to your loved one's doctor. And, you know, I have had to send forms to the DMV, and they'll take the license away. So, and that sometimes you have to do it. People don't like it.
And Nan, if they have an advanced directive for health care, are they allowed to talk to you? You have your parents' health care directive.
That is different. That does not necessarily, I don't think that necessarily translates.
So it can vary. You know, they do have a HIPAA, you know, there is a HIPAA release that's embedded in it. But, you know, again, it's up to providers to accept those and things like that. So it may vary from practice to practice. But generally the statutory form or, you know, certainly one that an elder care attorney is going to draft will have a HIPAA release embedded. And then when we're working with clients to kind of go that extra step, we make sure that anyone who's named in their documents is also going to be named in a HIPAA release form as well, so that they would have no problem accepting that, and it kind of makes it easy on everybody.
So we have that same problem when I help families with the Medicare, with the parents' drug lists and their things. If the person doesn't have the healthcare power of attorney, and they're like, oh, I'm just going to make all these decisions for mom. No, you can't. And I can't even discuss it with you unless your mom's on the phone and says, yes, please talk to my daughter. Usually it's the daughter. And or daughter for hire, right? Exactly. And that becomes a problem. And I've had some angry conversations. People are like, no, you just need to do this for me. I'm sorry. It's against the law.
I can't.
Michelle, you're like the team, right? You are the resource for all things elder care. Tell us a little bit about how you help families navigate. You know, we've noticed signs of dementia. We've noticed they can't really take care of themselves. Or should they be in their home anymore? You know, we're just confused and not sure what to do.
Yeah. So thank you for letting me be a part of this panel. I'm working as a geriatric care manager right now. So that's a term you all should be familiar with and jot down. Because what a geriatric care manager can do is come alongside each of our older adult individual clients as well as their family, help build a plan of care and help navigate through some of these tricky things like how do we start going to the doctor's appointments? Do we have all the right insurance products? Should we be seeing an elder law attorney? And all the different issues, and then having the end-of-life discussions. I make so many referrals to hospice that the doctors never, it's time. So as a geriatric care manager, what we can do, as Keith said, is sort of like be a daughter for hire. We can come alongside the family members and help navigate through a lot of these difficult conversations, work as a consultant and a coach, or even actually work at implementing some of the plans of care that we don't know how to do or don't have the resources for. A lot of my clients don't even have any family at all, so I'm the person who's taking them to their doctor's appointments and finding the assisted living communities and having the end-of-life conversations with them. Some of my clients have very involved family members, but they're just not making any progress, right? The joke I like to tell everybody is that my own family, right, don't listen to me, even though I'm a professional in the field. Sometimes we all need somebody that's outside of the family system in order to make progress on some of these difficult situations that we can find ourselves stuck in. And that's what a geriatric care manager can do. There's a national organization, the Aging Life Care Association, that a lot of geriatric care managers are members of. So if you're ever looking for anywhere across the country, you can go to that national organization and click on Find an Expert and find a geriatric care manager. And we're very fortunate in Atlanta to have some great geriatric care managers. I have a social work training, but a lot of us in the area also have a nurse background. So it's a great field and a great ally to have as part of the support team. The national organization is the Aging Life Care Association.
Mm-hmm. What are the options for care once we realize they can't really live independent? In-home, independent living, nursing, memory. What are the options and what are the costs for such?
So maybe you and I can do that
together.
So once we start figuring out that a person can't live on their own or can't take care of their own needs independently, the first thing we look at is family, right? So the first thing we look at is, are there any family members that can jump in and start helping out and maybe move in or move us in with them or somehow start incorporating the family system? The next step is usually to hire home care agencies. And Sam, what do you think the average cost is right now?
I mean, it can be about $100 a day, more than that. It just kind of depends on the cost and what level of care you need. Because as we're saying here, it's as the level of care is going to increase, obviously the cost is going to increase too. So what we do a lot of is we kind of help see where we're at and we kind of plan for what our potential future needs are going to be as we move from that care at home up to assisted living and then, so on and so forth, eventually maybe even to a skilled facility.
$100 will get you 4 hours of care.
That's right. Yes.
Maybe.
So it's more like $30 an hour.
Yeah.
Now.
That's right.
So has anybody had the pleasure of searching for an individual home care agency recently? So you're getting a good deal if you're getting $25 an hour, but you're right. I mean, the home care aides are very much in short supply, and so sometimes they're asking $30+ an hour in order to provide the care. So if you're thinking about being at home and hiring individual caregivers, you've got an hourly minimum of at least 4 hours, if not 6 or 8 hours per shift. They can provide up to 24/7 care. So you can get a lot of care in the home, but a lot of families look at that cost and then think about all the other costs they still have to go along with that, and then living in isolation in their home that might still need maintenance and the grocery shopping and the meal planning, they think this just isn't going to work. So then we start looking at institutional living, living in an independent living community, an assisted living community, a memory care, or a nursing home facility. Let's see, have any of you seen the Corso or the Terraces? Those are gorgeous communities that are pretty close to this area.
So Atlanta is having quite a boom in new development. And so we've got a lot of great different options, but I think as Sam was alluding to, it can get pretty expensive. So on average, our independent living communities are costing anywhere between $3,000 and $6,000 a month just for independent living, unless you're looking at the Corso, which could be $9,000, $10,000, or $11,000 for independent living. But if you start adding care on top of that and need assisted living, we're looking at $5,000, $7,000, $12,000 a month for that care. And then the highest level of care, our nursing home level of care, is costing about $10,000 a month right now in Atlanta. And then between nursing home and assisted living, we do have memory care units. So we have specialized units for people with memory or cognitive and thinking problems and memory issues. And those are costing probably around $7,000, $8,000 a month right now. You had a question.
Can you try, there are ways to qualify for Medicaid, and you know, my experience knowing nothing of this was my dad entered the healthcare system, went to a rehab facility, transferred to a nursing home, Medicare ran out, and then it was time to qualify him for Medicaid, which my mother would not do. But and my sister has no help. So at any rate, that's a family issue. But I am wondering now that we're here and knowing that my parent will be entering a nursing home, if there's a way to qualify a parent for Medicaid or Medicare benefits. He's a retired scientist with the government.
Yeah, so let's jump into how do people pay for that expensive level of care that they need?
Yeah, so, you know, as you've alluded to, you know, Medicaid here is not fully expanded, so not everyone can qualify immediately. So the more time we have, the better we can do a job of preserving assets and making sure that we're not necessarily having to spend down every dollar we have to qualify, right? So ideally, we get to meet with clients years in advance, and we kind of meet with them maybe when they first get a diagnosis, and we can sort of use our knowledge and knowledge of their personal situation to sit down with them and say, okay, here are what your financial assets are. Maybe here's what your property is. You know, do we need to retitle things to potentially shield them from Medicaid? Do we need to put, you know, a certain type of trust in place that will run for a certain amount of time and maybe keep assets from being looked at for Medicaid? So that's in a perfect world, right? Because we can really preserve the maximum amount of money and assets in that situation. But even if you come to us, you know, immediately, there are ways that you can preserve assets and still qualify for Medicaid. It depends on everyone's unique situation and how their assets are distributed, whether they are in cash or, you know, mutual funds, property, whether they're in retirement. It just kind of depends on the unique situation. And so that's why at Hurley we kind of get you in and we meet with you and we go through everything and we really kind of do an hour and a half to 2 hour consultation where we really take a personalized look at your situation and then we make a recommendation based on your situation to see what we can do to help you afford that care.
Because you can't just give away your stuff and get poor quick.
Right.
Not allowed to do that.
There's like a 5-year look back. You have to be incredibly poor to qualify for Medicaid. You're really not allowed to have much in the way of assets. Keith, while we've got you, what does Medicare actually cover when it comes to this?
The government, before Teddy Kennedy passed away, they tried to create a long-term care act called the CLASS Act. He died of brain cancer, I believe, right? And they quietly closed down the Government Long-Term Care Assistance Act, just shut the doors on it, because Medicare does not pay for, you know, assisted living, nursing homes. Medicare pays for skilled rehabilitation care. Okay, that means you need care. You need to show improvement, not being convalescent. Once you reach convalescent, that's nursing home or assisted living home care. So Medicare is allowing some of the newer plans to experiment, some of the new side of Medicare, where they're allowing the plans some new relaxation of rules to test out providing 4 hours a day of someone to cook or clean or bathe a person. That's the first time ever that Medicare is doing that. There's very limited home health care, wound dressing, and a few other items, but just don't expect Medicare to pay for your living needs at all. But we're seeing some neat innovations starting to happen. So some plans next year will give up to 160 hours of at-home care, which is a new thing.
Georgia plans?
Yep.
It's exciting.
I can teach you about those.
Please do.
Call Keith with your parents. One other thing I would say is once you get them into a nursing home or assisted living, it's not set it and forget it. There still has to be some level of engagement. I know I have a coworker here whose mom's in there, and they're not keeping up. Her medical records were switched, meds. So you really, Michelle, what's the best way to keep on top of that situation? I know with COVID and short staffing, there's definitely been some issues.
So you have to, even when your loved one lives in an assisted living community, a memory care, a nursing facility, you do have to be involved and aware and asking lots of questions. So show up at the care plan meetings, ask to see the medication administration record, ask about what the bathing schedule is, when the last time your loved one had a bath, when, like, how often or how much of their meals that they're actually eating, what kind of activities are they staying engaged in, and be there present and involved in advocating for good care. The staffing is difficult, and the turnover rate for staffing within each of these communities is very, very high. And so you might be the only consistent piece of your loved one's puzzle while they're in one of these communities.
Let me read a list of the typical things for home health under Medicare. A doctor has to certify this, so a doctor would have to do it. But you can have part-time or intermittent skilled nursing care, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech-language pathology, medical social services, part-time or intermittent home health aid, only if you're getting other skilled services like nursing or therapy at the same moment, injectable osteoporosis drugs, durable medical equipment, and medical supplies for use at home. I mean, it's a very limited scope.
That's
for just general Medicare. If your doctor certifies that you're under a plan of care and is regularly reviewing it, you may be eligible for some of those services. Okay.
So that's what Keith was reading, was the list of home health services, which is different than home care services, which
yep.
are the, what you are privately paying for
yep.
when you're signing up for home care services. So whenever your doctor's office or the hospital tells you, oh, don't worry, we'll get her set up with home health, just know that it's very episodic care. They step in and they provide exactly those services that Keith read, and then they leave and they move on to the next patient.
Time limited. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all very confusing, just labyrinth of things you go through. I'm sure everybody's kind of eyes are glazing over with all these different things. That's why you need people like Michelle who know how to navigate these waters and know the different types of resources that are out there, because there's just so many, and this is people that are in the industry, and it can be confusing to us. So I can imagine what it would be like to others who don't work in it day to day.
And so, Hugh, tell me this. Why is it that as soon as I can find any reason why, I refer them to hospice?
Well,
and the families are like, I don't think we're really quite there yet. And I'm like, maybe we are.
Okay,
because...
so that is a great softball question to make. It is... And I'm biased, admittedly, but there really is not a downside to involving hospice care. Even if you did a list of pros and cons, there's no cons. There's only pros that would come with that in terms of the services that they're going to get, which are going to be a registered nurse that's going to visit one or two times a week. They're going to have a nursing assistant who can come out, visit several times a week, a licensed social worker, an ordained chaplain that's available if people need it. All these things are covered under Medicare. This is one of the things that is covered under Medicare. Hospice is covered, and not only is it covered, it's covered at 100%. And so there's no out-of-pocket cost. So there's not even a negative in terms of, okay, well, we can't afford it right now, because it's all covered at 100%. In addition to those services, you're going to get the any durable medical equipment that they need, like a walker, wheelchair, bedside commode, hospital bed, things like that are provided. Any pharmacy, the medications that are related to their hospice diagnosis, pharmacy, the hospice will provide it, but they will also deliver it to the home. So there's none of this running back and forth to the pharmacy to get prescriptions filled, and supplies like gloves and adult briefs and things like that. We provide all of those. That's all part of the defined Medicare hospice benefit. And many managed care programs cover, they mirror what Medicare does. So they'll cover the same type of things if it's a managed care plan also. So there, you have everything to gain and really nothing to lose in having someone referred to hospice.
And how do you qualify for hospice?
So the Medicare guidelines are that the physician, the attending physician, it does require a doctor's order, that the attending physician and the hospice medical director feel like within their professional opinion that there is a 6 months or less life expectancy if the disease were to follow its natural progression. Doesn't mean that at 6 months and one day services are cut off and bye, we tried, it didn't work, none of that. It's that you continually are assessing, do we feel like we're in that 6 month window? Some diagnoses are easier to predict than others as far as a trajectory. And we have to assess it at the end of the first 90 days, at the end of the second 90 days, and then every 60 days thereafter, we have to do a clinical assessment that says, yes, we think we're still within that time frame. But the average, the problem with hospice is not that people are in it too long, it's that they wait too long to get it involved, and so it's too short. I mean, it's almost three-fourths of the people that receive hospice care get it for less than 3 weeks, and so it's not that people are doing it too soon. But it does require, it's different than like home care or things like that. It does require a doctor's order, so the physician has to feel like that this is something we want to recommend.
Great question. Is it my father was on hospice care at our home, but I can't recall. Is it the family or your decision of whether you would do it at home or go to a hospice facility?
So it is based on. There are, you can go to a facility, but there are separate criteria that Medicare has to go to a facility. And that's a very short-term arrangement. And this is a common misunderstanding that people have of hospice, is they think it's a place that you go and that you can stay there as long as you need to. It's really not a place. It's a concept of care. It's people coming to your home. If there are care needs and clinical needs that are out of control, that we need a more intensive 24/7 skilled nursing care, then you can use those facilities. But the average length of stay in those facilities is like 3 to 5 days. So it's not a long-term, you don't want to think in terms of long-term type placement for those type of things. So it's really, it's more not anybody's decision, but it's more based on what's going on clinically. And really, if the hospice is good, there are very, very, very few things that they can't handle at home. I mean, most scenarios can be, they would do the same thing at home that they would do in a building, and the majority of people would rather stay at home anyway.
Is it true that you have to kind of be stop all other methods of care and treatment to qualify for hospice? If I have cancer, we're no longer doing chemo. Is that correct?
Well, cancer is more cut and dry, yes. It is that you are choosing a palliative type of philosophy, and that your goals of care are not cure, but they are comfort, and that you want to maximize quality of life. So if you are aggressively pursuing curative type care, hospice is probably not the best option at that point. And cancer is the more, you know, it's the more obvious when you have radiation and chemotherapy. Usually people are saying, okay, we're not getting the results out of this that we wanted. It's not really helping. And I think it would be not in your best interest to continue these. It would probably do more harm than good. That's when it's a good time for hospice. However, there's other things. If people are getting, some people within my own family, I saw it. I mean, they thought that if somebody comes on hospice, we just immediately stop all their medicines and we just set up at the bedside and it's a death vigil. It's not that at all. And so if they're taking medicines for things like high blood pressure or things that are unrelated to the hospice, they can continue those. It's rare, but we have people that get physical therapy on hospice. And so there are, it's not a matter of just a hard stop on everything. It's more like, where are we philosophically now? Is our goal of care, is it cure? Or are we trying to maximize quality of life? And then once you get that goal set, then that's going to dictate what other treatments are going to continue on at that point.
Can I make a comment about initiating hospice? And one of the issues that I deal with a lot is folks who are living in assisted living or a nursing home, and the staff is very, I think staff in care facilities is very, they're very afraid to be told they're not doing their job. So in many cases, when someone is ill, they may be, and their goals of care are pretty set in their own mind and maybe in their family's mind. But one thing that hospice does is that when someone's in a facility, it makes it very clear what the goals of care are. We don't get people sent to the ER in the middle of the night because their heart rate was 120, because that's how that facility operates. So I think it's helpful in that way because people just take a deep breath and think, what is our goal here? We don't want to send this 103-year-old patient who really doesn't want to go to the hospital back to the hospital. And that's what we all want. So I think that it can be really helpful for the family, but it also can just makes things really clear for everyone that's taking care of the patient. And it doesn't mean that someone can't go to the hospital. That's one of the misconceptions that I see in my practice. There's never say never. You never say never. So you can rescind hospice at any time, and that there is. I always like for people to know that when we say we're not going to go to the hospital, that's barring any new things happening. And if someone's in pain, if someone needs care, we still take care of the patient. So it's overwhelmingly been a positive experience for my patients. So that's just
we talked about this earlier. that was it. 10% of people come out of hospice. So it's not a death sentence. They might get off of it. Correct.
Yeah. It's if we did one of those assessments at that 90 or 60 day intervals, and we said, you know what, we were wrong. We thought we were in the 6-month window. We're not. And they no longer meet that criteria. It's a good problem to have. But we help do some aggressive care planning for them to get them the resources that they need going forward. But yes, that does happen about 10% of the time that someone's referred to hospice and we were not correct in assessing that life expectancy and they come off of hospice because they no longer qualify.
But it gave them great care during that time period.
Yeah, and it makes it, when the time does come, it's so much easier. They're already familiar. They know what to expect. And it's just, again, there's just no downside. There's no penalty for that either. So it's not like they use up the benefit and they lose it and they can't use it again. It's an unlimited benefit. From a government standpoint, hospice is actually one of is encouraged from a cost-saving standpoint because our goal is to keep people out of the hospital so that we're not sending them back and forth to the emergency room. And so that's where the majority of the healthcare costs are incurred, is in those last months of life in an inpatient-type setting. And so we prevent that. Somebody has a question in the back.
So I'm back to
Yeah, so, you know, you've acknowledged sort of one of the unfortunate realities of our medical system, right? And that's that in order to qualify for Medicaid, you need to be, you know, very, very poor.
Destitute.
And yeah, exactly. And so that's just kind of one of the unfortunate realities. If income, you know, monthly income is the only thing kind of keeping a person from being eligible, there is a way to put in a certain type of trust that's fairly easy to operate that would go ahead and, even if their income's above the cap, it would go ahead and allow them to qualify for Medicaid and to just pay all of their income to the facility or, you know, even in some circumstances to the community spouse. But, you know, it's just one of those unfortunate realities that our Medicaid is not fully expanded, and so there are kind of people that fall through the cracks every once in a while.
I do want to say that for those of us in this room that are in our 40s and 50s, there are long-term care insurance policies that are dedicated to payment of long-term care. You need to be looking at them in your 40s and 50s. Harlan Grazer, who's with our firm, is here. You need to have a discussion with your spouse now. How are we going to fund this? Are we going to have a separate pool that we're going to have savings? Are we going to have one of us? Because when you're married especially, somebody's going to live in the home and someone might need to live in the facility. So you're carrying two homes. But you need to have the discussion of how you want to pay for that. Can you self-insure? Or do you want to have one of these policies that is a dedicated pool of dollars that's going to kick in? I rarely find clients and children of clients who are angry that their parents bought one of these. So, too late for our parents, but not too late for us.
Can I just add to that? So yeah. I'm Vicki's colleague, but she referenced that has gone through this, and I cannot emphasize that enough. My mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at 60 and was symptomatic at 57. So, if you think that this conversation is just about her elderly parents, it's not. So, she's now 71. She's been in assisted living for like 7 years. So, and when she was diagnosed, I was 30, my brother was 27. And like, had no idea what to do. So we used Hurley Law, I went to court and got a guardianship for her. We have a care manager. I cannot say enough about having a care manager because they did send us the wrong medical files. It's a really, really nice facility, but everyone is incredibly understaffed. So they are making mistakes. And between my brother and I, we have 4 children of age 6. So we can't, like,
take active care of on a daily basis. So we have a care manager who does. I talked to her yesterday. So I cannot, it's worth every penny to hire somebody like that. I'm happy to talk to you all about that. We also use a consultant on the front end to help us find an assisted living facility because we had no idea. Again, we were in our early 30s, we had no idea what we were doing. None of our friends had ever been through this before. We're going to be very first people. So I cannot emphasize enough, this is for obviously thinking about your elderly parents, but do your children, give your children the gift. Even if you're like me and you're in your early 40s and start having this conversation now with them, because you don't want to be in a position where you're having to go to court when you're 30 years old to get a guardianship for your mother. So you're just completely unprepared. So I'm happy to answer questions too, kind of a real life situation, but I mean, I think this is incredibly timely and relevant. I wish I had gone through this panel, you know, 11 years ago. So.
Sounds like you did the right thing, Zoe.
We have another question here, Claire.
Along the lines of preparing in advance, when you went at the beginning, when you went through the different levels of care and the approximate costs, can you comment about the concept of the continuous care retirement community and how that fits in? And from a, does that make sense from a standpoint financially and planning wise?
Keith just gave a heavy sigh.
He totally does.
So we have four continuous care retirement communities in the Atlanta area. These are campuses that all on one campus have independent living, assisted living, memory care, and nursing home care. So on one campus they have the whole continuum of care. The model, the thing that makes it a CCRC, which I think now they're called life care communities. Life plan, they've changed their names, but we also call them CCRCs. The thing that makes it the CCRC is that you buy in. So up front, you put in a cost, you put in a good amount of money up front. It could be $250,000, $500,000, $1 million that you put up front. And you don't become an owner, it's just what you buy, that's what your buy-in is for the CCRC. After you move out or after you die, your estate could get back up to, I think most of them give back 90%. Is that what most of y'all are saying? So you get back 90% of what you bought in, or the estate gets it back. And then you still have pretty hefty monthly fees. So if you're in the independent living community side, you still have independent living fees. If you go into assisted living, how much you pay depends on how much care you're getting. Same as if you're in the memory care or in the nursing home side. I especially like CCRCs if there's a couple and one of the spouses has a significant illness. So one spouse has Parkinson's disease or MS or maybe mild cognitive impairment. Sometimes a CCRC does make a lot of sense because they'll be able to age in place together on one campus, and it should be pretty easy to navigate. By the time clients usually come to me, there's already something happening in their lives. Right, there's usually some sort of event that has happened. They're usually years past the diagnosis, and so by the time my clients come to me, it doesn't usually make sense for them to buy into a CCRC. But if somebody, if you have parents who are moving from New Jersey to Atlanta and they're already in their early 70s and they're very active, it makes a lot of sense for them to move into a CCRC and make that commitment up front, where it's a very robust community filled with great activities. All of our CCRCs are large communities, so there's great opportunities to socialize and get engaged and stay active, and they're beautiful. I mean, the ones that we have here are beautiful and are usually pretty well-staffed. One thing that's interesting about our CCRCs is that nobody wants to make the transition to the next level of care. So most of our CCRCs are filled with people who have moved into the independent living and are still hiring outside help to come in, because nobody wants to be that person who moves to the assisted living because, you know, we're all ageist. So I don't want to go live over there. That's where all the really, you know, debilitated people are with the walkers. So we have a lot of folks who age in place in their apartments, and then we have lots of empty assisted living communities. Or at Lynbrook, there's a wait list to get into the health facility living part. Yeah.
Is
I don't know.
If...
Uh-huh.
What are the four? Yeah. What are the four CCRCs in Atlanta?
It's Peachtree Hills.
Peachtree Hills Place.
Yeah, Peachtree Hills Place.
Well, they're different. It's interesting. So the Isaacson Living Group decided not to make Peachtree Hills an independent living. You buy your condo at Peachtree Hills Place.
Okay, so, it is a little
bit. It's $1 million, like, you buy your condo, and then they have assisted living, memory care, and nursing home on site, so they can still accept people from outside the community. But okay. Their sister property, Park Springs in Stone Mountain, I don't know if you've had a chance to ever tour that community. It's gorgeous. They're a CCRC owned by the same people that build Peachtree Hills. We have Lynbrook, the other one in Buckhead.
Canterbury.
Thank you. Canterbury. And
Corso is a CCRC.
Is it Wesley Woods one?
Wesley Woods is not. There's the one that's out in Austell. Presbyterian Village. Thank you. And St. Anne's is not, right? It's just independent living. Oh, and Gainesville has a new one. That's right. Yep, Gainesville has a new one. And I think, did Rome build a new one too? Anyways, there's some other interesting ones that are popping up. Corso is an interesting model where they have independent living, assisted living integrated within the community. So almost all of our other communities have independent living and personal care or assisted living separate. They're on separate floors. The Corso is our first community who is starting, like, they just start from the get-go of, like, if you have whatever apartment you have is your apartment, and you could have either independent living services there or it's assisted living. So it's not, your care level isn't determined by where you live in the building. Your care level is determined by what you need, unless you need memory care, in which case they do have that separate. So that's an interesting model that's going to be fun to watch.
So Corso is a CCRC.
It's not a buy-in.
It's not.
Mm-mm. Just start to $7,000 a month.
It looks like Versailles.
It does look like. Oh yeah.
Of course.
Okay. So I have a question. I actually have one thing to share and then one question. So one thing I'm going to share is something that I've learned with kind of going through this journey and looking for a place is if you think you need to start living, do it much earlier than you think you need to. Something I didn't know and maybe you don't need to touch on is to get into memory care facilities. Like, my thought was, oh, one day when that needs to happen, just do it. What I've learned going for these places is that you have to qualify. A lot of memory care facilities, they say you have to be able to walk in. The patient has to be able to walk in on their own. Certain laws are in place. So there's just a lot more to it than just signing on the dotted line and giving them your money. So that's just something I wanted to share. And then also going through this process it is very expensive, but there's a little bit room sometimes for negotiation. I've talked with some other people who have done this, and they're going to tell you a price, but don't hesitate to say, negotiate that, or is there any room? There's also a lot of community fees, and kind of think back to when you were renting. There's things that they can do, they can maybe certain fees, things like that. So just, it's not exactly a hard and fast.
Yeah, but there are professionals that will tour you in those facilities. We know them. We work with them. You'll do that some, right, also. But there are professionals that will find people and say, look, do you need a personal care home or do you need a memory facility? They know all the fees. They know that negotiating amount, and you don't have to pay them. The facility pays them. When you get placed there, they get paid by the facility for bringing up a patient there. So the best thing that was said today was don't do the trial and error. Don't beat yourself up trying to figure – don't tune up your own car. Okay, go to professionals. Sometimes you have to pay for the professionals. My agency is free. We're not allowed to charge. But it's better than beating your head against the wall trying to figure things out on your own.
But part of that requirement about being able to, when they say walk across the threshold and things like that, is because a lot of people don't realize that these assisted living communities do not have skilled nursing. So it is these are med techs or certified nursing assistants, but they're not RNs. That are there 24/7, and so there may be one RN who's the wellness director, and more times than not, that person's an LPN rather than an RN. But people think that they're coming into a skilled facility, and it's not skilled at all. So because they don't offer that, that's why they require you have to be somewhat independent.
So that kind of brings me to my question, which is more, I guess, Georgia or state focused. What are the differences in these facilities and the term agent place, and knowing which facilities are properly licensed to allow your loved one to agent place, and kind of what does that end of life look like? Because they aren't skilled nursing facilities, so if they have the proper licensure, I'm trying to understand, are they able to stay there until their end of life, or is there a certain point, if you are still private pay, that they need to be transferred out to the proper care?
So Georgia basically has two levels of licensure for our care homes. And this is if they're not a nursing home, but if they're a community that's not a nursing home. We have two levels of licensure. The first is the personal care home licensure. It's the licensure we've had the longest. The second is the assisted living license level. And that's our newest one, which the assisted living communities, the ones that are licensed as assisted living communities, are the ones who've co-opted the age in place. Because by regulation, if you live in a personal care home, so if the home that you're living in and getting care in is actually a personal care home, by licensure and by regulation, they cannot retain you as a resident once you lose the ability to ambulate, once you can't take your own medications, once you can't do a lot of things on your own, and you need a higher level of care. By regulation, they're not allowed to keep you in the community and have to discharge you to a higher level of care. For years, this has been disruptive to a number of residents and families, and so advocates advocated for a higher level of care, the assisted living level of care. So now by regulation, if you are an assisted living community, then what you've done is you've proven to the state that you have sprinkler systems in place, like even sprinklers inside of your closets, you know, that you've got med techs that are on staff who've been trained on how to administer medications, not just give medication reminders. And there's other qualifying things that the assisted living communities have had to do in order to say, you know what, we can take care of folks who lose the ability to ambulate, who lose the ability to self-administer their own medications. We can take care of them. And the regulation allows them to do staffing that's appropriate to the care level needs of that building. So that's how it looks all on paper, right? And so the assisted living communities say, once you move in with me, you can age in place. We will never kick you out. Assisted living communities still kick people out once they need too much care. So what you do in order to best prepare yourself is you consult with one of the folks that Keith was talking about, one of our placement specialists in the Atlanta area, because they know which communities are actually keeping and taking care of folks to the end of life and can help you navigate through that. So if they know that your loved one is facing a debilitating illness and is likely going to need a high level of care for many years, they can help you find a community that's less likely to discharge them once they need a higher level of care. Now, ownership changes, administrators change, nurses change, and then their policies change, but they can help guide you to maybe the best practices on the front end to prepare for that kind of situation.
It's and another most will great. They'll let you stay if you're on hospice and they need a higher level. That's an exception that they'll make. If hospice is involved, they can stay.
So once a personal care home starts telling me that my client needs to leave, I'm like, hey, Capstone, can you come in? And we've been able to keep folks in a personal care home for a little bit longer by increasing the outside support. Or you can do things like hire a home care aide. So if your loved one has really gotten attached to their community and so the care team that's there, we can hire in some additional care to support the personal care home. And the personal care homes aren't being mean. It's just that if they are audited by the state, they're going to get in big trouble by having people in the building who need a Hoyer lift or who need a higher level of care than they're regulated to give. So it's a hard journey for sure.
Claire, question here and question there.
I'm already very loud. My dad unfortunately was diagnosed with dementia when he was 67, and one of the hardest parts of dealing with his care was his initial resistance to, he was probably the most anxious person of all, to going into a memory care facility. What advice do you have for helping a partner, a spouse, a parent, you know, really come to terms with it and making that transition? Because I know so many people are so resistant.
Do you want to start with that one, or do you want me to? Either way.
It's one of the hardest things that I deal with on a daily basis with my patients and with my own family. But it's really hard, and when you see, I see a lot of patients who have a little bit of memory loss. So they're legally competent, but they make really bad decisions. So that, and many people who don't have dementia fall into that category, as well as people who do have dementia. So it's really hard. And, you know, our legal professional here can attest to, it's always better to do things the soft way rather than the hard way. And legally, you know, it's much easier if you can convince someone that this is going to be the right thing to do. But in general, I find it incredibly hard. And if someone doesn't want to go to memory care, occasionally they will accept assisted living because it doesn't sound so bad. But we end up in the same place anyway. As far as most of my patients lately that have gone to memory care are pretty far advanced. In general, I don't see many people who don't have very advanced disease going any, you know, you don't see mild dementia going to memory care. Assisted living or home care is what I see most of the time.
Unless they're 67 and physically fit and a wonder risk, right?
Yeah. And that's a question that I have for you too, as far as, and I have this conversation with families a lot, is should we go to memory care or should we go to assisted living? And that can be, wander risk is really probably the biggest factor there.
And there are communities like the Orchard of Brookhaven. I don't know if anybody knows the Orchard of Brookhaven, but it's a community that is almost exclusively dementia care. It has five different levels within the building. So they can move into what feels like assisted living because they have access to the whole building, but the whole building is secure and the whole building is staffed by people who are trained in dementia care and then can make the transition within the building as the disease progresses. So sometimes that's easier than making a move into an assisted living community where their memory care facility is downstairs in the basement or it's way back in the back, which feels very stigmatizing to somebody who might be in the early stages of dementia. So sometimes you can pick a community that feels more inclusive, and so it doesn't feel as difficult to move. In terms of how to start talking to somebody, I would say that one thing we have to remember, which I think is incredibly hard for those of you who've lived with your loved ones for 3 decades, 4 decades, 5 decades, is that we can't be rational with somebody who's lost the ability to be rational, right? And so we have to figure out other ways to have those conversations and to make progress on getting into assisted living. So it's, you know, well, you know, mom's going to be out of town for her sister's thing, and so you need to go somewhere and stay. You know, so it's like you're not having a straightforward confrontation about what the needs are at hand, but more of a, how can we get this person on board with what's needed. I have a client right now who's living in memory care because, you know, her insurance wasn't paying for the independent living, but the memory care is paid for by the insurance, which is not true, right? But she's like, okay, I could save $3,000 a month if I make this move to the next facility. And we're like, all right, let's do it. And she's having a great time. She loves it. Another client is having some major duct work in her house and couldn't live there anymore. So, you know, and now the builders just keep pushing back the schedule, but she is loving her memory care unit. She loves it. So, you know, sometimes it's not about going through the front door. We figure out what's the side door that they can live with.
I recently heard the term therapeutic lying, which
it's true.
It's just great because sometimes you have to do that. And it's really helpful to make it feel a little better because it feels bad.
We have a couple, so I'm going to come here, and then over here, and then here, and then I'll come to you.
I have a unique problem that is not a problem. Both of my parents, one's 89, the other's 90. No dementia, nothing headed that way. They're completely, kind of like they always have been, but extreme, sudden mobility issues. What they need help with, I'm thinking, is completely uncovered. That's my question. I'm hoping for an answer. cancer that it's not 100% out of pocket, but things like laundry and home cooking, they don't really want to move anywhere. So I didn't really know what was available at that point beside me. And, I mean, I'm Irish by background, but a watchful woman for life is not what I'm kind of looking for. And the other thing is the definition of assisted living. Is that health related, or what exactly?
So the first, are your parents in Atlanta?
They're in Atlanta in my house. That would be a hard yes.
So needing help with custodial services, we do have some programs through our area agency on aging or through the county aging services. You can imagine that most of those are underfunded and have a pretty long wait list, but it's always worth calling the county aging services and asking about services, as well as calling in Atlanta, it's the Atlanta Regional Commission is our AAA, and so calling them and asking about if they qualify and if they could get put on the wait list. But usually that's a private pay service that you're looking for. So I would check out those two resources and then think about some private pay resources. And I'm pretty excited about what NeighborForce and what Panda are doing in Atlanta.
I just learned about NeighborForce, which is kind of like a home care agency that does just those kind of things. Like they don't do any kind of medical care or anything like that, but they do help with the laundry, cooking, cleaning, things like that. And so I thought that was a kind of a neat concept, and I'm sure it's less expensive than paying someone who's going to do medical type things. Well,
I want to make a suggestion. There's a mobility solutions providers that'll come and evaluate the home and see if it's safe, if there's things that need to be fixed or removed, or that can provide solutions like getting in and out of bathtubs and out of bed and that type of stuff. So
the NeighborForce is NABOR. It's not like your next door neighbor.
NABOR.
Mm-hmm.
NeighborForce. Okay.
NAB. B as in boy. Yeah.
So NeighborForce works with a minimum of 1 hour. So you think about our home care agencies that are working with a minimum of 4, 6, or 8 hours. So it gives you a lot more flexibility. And they're very task-oriented to do the things on the task. Some caregivers through caregiver agencies want to just help with caregiving. And they're like, I'm not here to do housekeeping. And I'm not good at cooking. So, you know, in some ways, NeighborForce is a good resource for that. There's another agency that's very similar to NeighborForce called Panda. It's Personal Assistant Next Door. And so if you can look up Panda, that's another one that's offering the same kind of on-demand personal assistance services.
But those are all private pay.
All private pay. That's right. And then I think, Keith, your suggestion, too, is a really good one. So we have a couple of...
Is it Sage Home? They just changed their name.
They just changed their model. They're not doing...
They're not doing the in-home assessments anymore. 101 Mobility, I think, will still do the assessments.
Mm-hmm. And then Andrew Siever with... I remember Andrew's name, but I can't remember the name of his company right now. He's an occupational therapist who does home evaluations and then gives you a recommendation of like, okay, if you put a grab bar here and if you do some of these like minor changes around the house, it'll help out with some of the accessibility and mobility.
And fire departments will bring in things to help people, seniors especially. Bed shakers, because they'll take out the hearing aids. They can't hear the fire alarm going off. So there's bed shakers. There's things that'll turn off the oven.
The fire department?
Gwinnett County Fire Department does that. They'll come out and do evaluations and help to make the house safer.
But before you're writing everything down furiously, I can probably speak for everybody at this table. I mean, we're all in the helping profession, so just grab one of our cards before you leave. You could contact any of us, and I'm sure we would give you resources, emails, things like that. Nobody's going to say, oh, that's not my I don't have time for that. So
sure. We're all part of ASC, right?
That's right.
Well, there's a good group you're all part of called ASCNN.org. It's Atlanta Care
Senior Care Network.
Senior Care Network niche. And there's a whole list of participating members in there with all different categories of care, right?
So I wanted to introduce a couple of things, just especially to help for everyone to know about the long-term care insurance products that either you may have purchased or you know that your parents have some long-term care policies. I think it would be helpful for everyone to know how they actually operate. Two things to understand about long-term care insurance. Number one is there is a common misperception that if the insured person moves to an assisted living facility, then long-term care policy will automatically take care of it. Not so. You have to qualify to start receiving benefits from the long-term care policy. And there are two ways to qualify for benefits. It's either A, trigger A or trigger B. Trigger A is someone, like a geriatric care manager or a doctor or a licensed social worker, some third-party medical professional, has to certify that the insured individual needs what's called substantial assistance with any two out of six activities of daily living. That's a specified list. The six are eating, bathing, dressing, toileting, maintaining continence, and what's called transferring. So it's not total mobility. That transferring is just the ability to get yourself from a bed to a chair or vice versa. So if you need substantial assistance with any two out of those six, that satisfies trigger A. The other option is to qualify for benefits under trigger B, which is the cognitive impairment trigger, which says that a medical professional has to certify that you require substantial supervision because you pose a threat to your own health or safety or those around you due to cognitive impairment. So that's the dementia, the Alzheimer's type of situation typically is what satisfies that. So simply moving to an assisted living facility or something like that does not, if you say, mom really can't take care of herself, she needs someone to do this, that, or the other, maybe that qualifies for long-term care benefits if she has such a policy, but it might not. So someone has to do that certification. The second thing to understand is that when you're thinking that the parent, say your parent, is at that point, they do have a policy and they're at that point where you think they do qualify, that is the point to consider bringing in a professional geriatric care manager to help with to help make that assessment. And the reason that I routinely recommend that is because long-term care claims can be a messy process. Carriers do not routinely automatically and quickly approve claims for benefits to begin under a long-term care policy. It sometimes is a very lengthy and kind of a messy process because you have to prove the satisfying of trigger A or trigger B, et cetera. And then you run into the problem that Isabel touched on earlier, where you might have a parent who's a little resistant or a little bit in denial. So when the long-term care insurance carrier sends a representative to interview your parent, and they sit down across the table and say, can you do this? Can you do this? Can you do this? And your parent says, oh, yes, I can do that. Sure, yes. Well, that's all the carrier needs to deny the claim. So it is often very helpful to have an independent third party, like a professional geriatric care manager, come in and be there at that assessment to help be the third party to give, shall we say, color commentary to what the insured individual truly can and cannot do in order to maximize the chance that they're going to have a claim approved. So just wanted to share that.
Thank you, Harlan.
And then we'll stay off track.
Okay, any other questions? I feel like we had one at this table. There we go.
Three for me.
Very quick.
If you're not in a 5-alarm fire situation, you can hear now, and your parents are still mostly there, what's the one thing you'd recommend somebody do with their parents? I don't know, there's several different types of consultants you talk about. It's a little confusing as to when you invoke one or the other. Just what can we do now to kind of get ahead of things and also get mom and dad ahead of a place of what's going to happen? Next 5 to 12 years, and then I just wanted to follow up on that with Are there any unique considerations if we were trying to decide whether it's parent in your home state or moving to Georgia? And any unique considerations if we're dealing with step parents versus our biological parents?
Let me tell you, I deal with all different levels of seniors. So there'll be super healthy, regular people that just retired and playing golf. But by having a Medicare advisor, and we track all of their services, when things do go bad, the family can come in and see what has dad been doing these last 5 years with his health care? What doctor lists has he been given Keith to track? What drugs has Keith been tracking? And we can help them build their Medicare account so they can see all the claims that have been happening. So if the family can get their power of attorney done, we can show them, we can open the world to them and show them all of these things that normally you wouldn't have a clue how to find it. But then we are networking with all of these other type of professionals, and we can tell the family, you need this other service, you need this other professional, and we can refer them. So we have about 150 different referral partners, the people that are all over Georgia that we'll send people to get services.
We've included an elder care checklist in the brown folder, and you can if they're willing to sit down with you and say, Mom, Dad, this is something we want to talk to you. You know, what are your wishes? What do we, you know, where do you keep your important documents, passwords? It's about a 3 or 4 page printout in there. If they're open to it and willing, you could start there and say, you know, I just need to have an idea of, you know, where your bank account is. I don't even know how much is in it, but really, that can be a conversation starter as well.
I think too, Justin, just to piggyback on what Keith just said, is that the Medicare process is extremely complicated, right? I mean, anybody who's gone through that process yourself or with your parents, you realize there's a ton of different things. And so you could even navigate that conversation as, let's help get your Medicare in order, and that's something that's probably very top of mind. Right? Like, what's the best plan for me to get it? What's the cheapest? What are the best
drugs? Well, let's talk about it. His second question was about moving, yeah. Right? So when you move, that's especially a transition time to manage the Medicare. They're leaving Miami and losing their Medicare plan in, you know, Broward County. Well, they need to get a Medicare plan in Fulton County now. So it's a time of transition, but people don't even know they have to call or go to Social Security and change their address. They don't even know that, you know, so because I can't enact a new plan if the government still thinks you're in Broward County. Right. So it's moving is a big time for us to manage people's Medicare.
But that's like a softball. It's very helpful for them. Yeah. I think that can help to navigate other people.
So I think to the first question about what to do now, I agree with them. And it's just like what Nan said at the beginning is be aware, like start having these conversations, make it a regular part of what your relationship is evolving into. And so it becomes more of a normal thing and say, you know, if you get hit by a bus, if you, you know, we should all know these things. It's not just about you getting, about you aging. It's about, I could be the person who's tapped for you and I want to know how to help jump in.
Yeah.
And then in terms of like moving to Georgia versus your home state, I think that really depends if you are what we call a dual eligible. So if the person that you're thinking about moving here qualifies for both Medicare and Medicaid or could potentially in the future, I think it's really important to be aware of what dual eligibles are entitled to in Georgia, which compared to other states is potentially not as robust here in Georgia as it is in other places, right? So I've had folks from the Northeast call and they say, you know, like, well, I live down here, but my mom lives in New York and she's on Medicaid and they're providing her with a 24/7 sitter through Medicaid that their waiver program's paying for. Okay, Georgia doesn't have anything like that. The most that you could get here is up to 40 hours a week of in-home care through our Medicaid waiver program. So it's 40 hours a week versus 24/7 a day. And right now, our Medicaid waiver programs can't even fulfill the shifts that they're promising to their older adults. Right?
Michelle, is that because we don't have expanded Medicaid? When I hear that, is that what that means?
So for that program, so this is part of our long-term services and supports that we do here, well, that every state's mandated to take care of in some way, and we just have not expanded the services that we're providing through the long-term services and support. So we're underfunding our home and community-based services, which is the elderly and disabled waiver program, and that wait list is just way too long. And they're funding that program at rates that are what, from 2008, 2010? So when they're looking at paying their providers, they're not keeping up with what the current market is demanding. And so the providers can't pay their workers enough to entice them to join and to take on the work.
make sure everyone understands, Medicare is all, no matter what state you're in, Medicare is a federal program. Plans can vary state by state, but Medicare is federal. Medicaid is state and federal cooperative, and what is the states pay 10% and federal pays 90 or so, something like that. So it can vary. They're allowed, each state's allowed to make their Medicaid different than another state.
So I hear a lot of folks thinking about moving here from others. Oh, another one that I hear a lot is that somebody's in Florida and they're on Medicaid and Medicaid's paying for their assisted living community in Florida. In Georgia, by regulation, our assisted living communities cannot take Medicaid dollars. There's a movement to change that, but right now they can't. So if you have a loved one who's in Florida and potentially going to use Medicaid dollars to pay for their assisted living, that's not going to be reciprocated here in Georgia, at least the way the current regulations are. If, however, we're not a dual eligible and you're that's not a concern, moving to Georgia to be closer to family purely is a great idea for the most part. I would also look at, though, and compare how are the assisted living communities in their current home state comparing with what Georgia's doing. I think the last time I saw a comparison, Georgia was like number 48 when it came to long-term care services. So if they're in a state that's doing better, which is almost all the other states, that's something worth considering.
Sorry,
too.
Alabama.
All right, we're doing better than Mississippi and Alabama. But like I remember one time going up and taking a tour of communities, of facilities in New Jersey, and I was like, holy smokes, like, they look better, the care is better. It just was a completely different ballgame. So it's worth considering. But being close to family and having that increasing quality of life is also meaningful. There was a question about step-parents.
Yeah, so, I mean, biological children are going to have some access to be able to help with decisions that stepchildren may not. So, you know, if you as a stepchild are going to be involved in the care for a parent, and you want to be named on documents that are going to give you that authority to do it, whether it be a power of attorney, a health care directive, because statutorily there's not going to be much coverage for that. And then just to kind of reemphasize what everyone's been saying about when, you want to get involved in the long-term care planning, hopefully when mom and dad can kind of be on board too, right? Because when they're involved in decision-making, it goes a lot smoother, and they can be a part of the plan, and it just really kind of makes it easier to transition from maybe one role from them to another role, from caregiver to being cared for. So just getting in, and not only kind of maintains as many tools in the belt that we can call on later when we need them, but it just makes the whole process a lot smoother.
And it'll make it cheaper. I mean, I think the attorneys usually can make a lot of money from these blended families who haven't done any proactive planning. And it's messy and uncomfortable and painful. So, I agree with you. Like, start talking early.
All right. Any final questions? The panelists will be here after. If you have questions, go.
I want to go back to your question earlier about Medicaid and just let everybody know that one thing that I love about Hurley Elder Care Law is they have these wonderful and complimentary consultations, phone consultations. You can call into their office, and they'll spend a great deal of time talking to you about the facts of your situation and then help you understand over the phone if it's worth pursuing, what your rights and eligibility are, and if there is something there, if there is a reason to maybe go for an emergency Medicaid planning meeting with the attorney, they'll get you pointed in that direction. But it's a great service that y'all provide the community for sure. Is that phone consultation?
So we've recorded this session. It's going to live live on Signature FD's website, as well as our speakers are free to use it. If you want to forward it on or you missed anything today, feel free. If you have questions, the panelists will be here afterwards. I want to thank everyone for coming. I think we all learned a lot today. Thank you.